Sticks and hits and goals and saves and slap shots and goons. We've got sportly commentary to an NFL commute. But we also cover movies, TV shows, hits and tunes. It's your weekly bowl of hockey and nonsense. Part two.
I'm Greg Wyshynski of ESPN, the home of the NFL draft, which by the time you probably hear this, you'll know whether it was great or maybe not.
I'm Ryan Lambert. I don't know anything about the NFL.
Sean McAnoo from The Athletic. I can't wait to watch the NFL draft and see some kind of normal sports. I'm a little too excited for this.
I refuse to believe that you don't know anything about the NFL, Ryan, because you live in Boston, and I have to imagine that it's 24/7 Gronk to the Bucks.
Yeah, but like, where am I seeing this? I don't have cable. I wouldn't watch like a fucking New England sports roundup show. Like, there's no. I saw that the trade happened. I don't know anything beyond. I don't know what they got for him. I don't know. What this actually means for anybody. Is Gronk still good? I don't know. I thought he retired. Apparently he didn't. None of this matters to me.
I just assume that everywhere you go, like if you're walking your sweet pup, people are like, you know, just coming up and just, you know, talking about Gronk. Like, that's just how I picture Massachusetts as a whole, to be quite honest with you.
I swear, this is 100% true. I know more about Gronk as a professional wrestler than I do as an NFL player.
I have to give credit to Marissa and Jemmy, who was on ESPN on Ice this week, former Boston Herald writer, because I believe she's the one who suggested that whoever tackles Gronk first in week one gets to win the 24/7 title.
I think that's how it works. They'll get the belt off him before that. It'll be a classic, you know, Montreal screw job type of a situation if worse comes to worse. But there's no way they're letting him go on an NFL game as the 24/7 champion.
Oh, yeah. God forbid God forbid he walks out on week one and throws the 24/7 belt in the trash.
That's exactly right.
Then what? Yeah. We wanted to start the show with a quick discussion about perfect movies. James Gunn, the man behind Guardians of the Galaxy, Slither, and the baffling sequel to Suicide Squad called The Suicide Squad, which is coming out at some point, had a thread about perfect movies. Now,
wait, is that a real
one
thing?
One of his perfect movie.
What you the just Suicide said about Squad? They're making another version of a movie nobody liked and just changing one word in the title.
Well, they're making a sequel to it. You see, like, Harley's going to be in it, and if he's smart, Viola Davis will be in it because she's arguably the only good thing from the first Suicide Squad. But yeah, it's a sequel to Suicide Squad called The Suicide Squad.
You comic book guys are out of control. Like, just make a movie.
It's too much.
And then
it's
the movie can be much. Done. Like, that's... Oh, all right.
I completely agree. And it... No, it's fine, and my biggest problem with it is that it breaks the genre movie naming convention. Everyone knows that the sequel is just you add an S to the end, like Aliens. It should be Suicide Squads. Suicide Squad.
Whoppers Jr.
I think before I interrupted, Greg, you were trying to say Suicide Squad is the perfect movie. I think that was the point you were...
Okay. Listen, it might be the perfect trailer. It got me to watch that piece of shit, but... Now, James Gunn, amongst his picks, Raiders of the Lost Ark, which then had people out of the woodwork again to point out the thing of, Indiana Jones.
Yeah.
No. The thing about how Indiana Jones doesn't do anything in the movie. Like, the movie happens whether or not...
Yeah, but I mean, like, that's not true, though. They were digging in the wrong place in Egypt. We all... Like, they would not have found the chamber without Indiana Jones. But otherwise, that is a correct take. Other than the fact that it's wrong, it's right.
Right. I mean, not only that, but also at the end, I mean, he and Marion are there, right? And if he doesn't say, hide your eyes, and she gets her face melted too. So at least he did that.
Sure. Anyway, point is, that's...
And he chose not to blow up the Ark with the bazooka too. Anyways, it is a perfect movie.
Wow.
One of the choices that he made was... Back to the Future, where he said, and I quote, Back to the Future could seemingly could be imperfect. And then in parentheses, why don't mom and dad remember Marty? But I would still argue it's a perfect film because there are reasons why this could conceivably be the case. I have to admit that as someone who has seen Back to the Future on numerous occasions, that
never occurred
flaw
to you?
Never occurred to me. Yeah. It never imprinted on my brain that was something that people bring up about the movie. Like, oh, perfect movie, save for this fact. Like, and that never – did it occur to you, like, all the times you saw it?
I have to admit that it was pointed out online. Like, I saw it online however many years ago, and I was like, oh, yeah, that's fucking weird. But
Sean, was that ever a thing that you
– No, so I'm sorry. What the complaint is that they don't – the parents don't recognize him. Like, what? They don't realize that their son looks exactly the same.
They don't go like, oh, you have – you bear an uncanny resemblance to Calvin Klein.
To Calvin Klein, yeah.
Right.
Right. To the guy who thrust us together.
But that was like in the 50s. It's not like they've got photos on their phone that they could just call up. That seems reasonable. They would kind of have forgotten what – I don't remember what people look like that I met 2 months ago. So.
Yeah, but – but you like if it was this guy you met who introduced you to your wife, I think you might have a more strong
and who you know dressed like he was from a different time and played Johnny B. Well, they don't know he played Johnny B. Good, right? That was while they were both outside.
Well, and also in their reality, you know, he is the original.
It was
writer
written by a white man. Right. Yeah, exactly.
Right, and then Marvin Berry stole it. So, but here's the thing. Bob Gale, who is the screenwriter for Back to the Future, actually chimed in on this. And this is why I bring it up, because I found this to be fascinating. It's a pure COVID-19 quarantine fairy tale of all of these discussions happening and then someone who has no time on his hands being like, I'll chime in to the Hollywood Reporter. This is what Bob Gale says. Bear in mind that George and Lorraine only knew Marty Calvin for 6 days when they were 17, and they did not even see him every one of those days. So many years later, they might still remember that interesting kid who got them together on their first date. But I would ask anyone to think back on their own high school days and ask themselves how they remember a kid who might have been at their school for even a semester or someone you went out with just one time. If you have no photo reference after 25 years, you'd probably just have a hazy recollection. So George and Lorraine might think it's funny that they once met someone named Calvin Klein and they thought that their son had some resemblance to him, but it wouldn't be a big deal. And also, he wasn't even in the yearbook, as Gale points out, too.
Yeah.
So there's no,
that's
the record
completely
of it.
The correct take. That's
great.
And also, what are they supposed – even if they are looking at their son going, he looks like that guy, what are they supposed to do? Like, they're just – are they going to look at each other and be like, oh, my God, our son was a time traveler?
Right.
Or are they going to be like, yeah, those people look kind of the same? Like, that's –
Now, it's entirely possible that George McFly does come to that conclusion, being that he's George McFly.
True.
That's also Lorraine, true. Yeah.
What if
true.
Our son is a time travel? And then she just shoots it down. But yeah, I did not know this was a considered to be a flaw in the film, and two, am happy that it is now canon, courtesy of the screenwriter, that we fixed it. So we closed the time loop. The anomaly has been fixed. In Back to the Future,
that was a close one.
By the way, Back to the Future, perfect movie or no? I guess would be the question.
I mean, it's fun. It's really like it's one of those things where it's very difficult now to go, oh, that is like that's not a good movie. And do I think it's a good movie just because it came out when I was 3 years old or what? I don't know. I have no way of knowing that anymore. So
if we divorce. Like the movies that we saw as kids from the perfect movie debate, because our perceptions might be warped. I would say the most perfect like entertainment movie. Not perfect, like there will be blood, right? Like, you know,
sure.
Come on.
Well, I just read that movie actually isn't good. There was a Guardian the other day.
A woman in the Guardian saw it for the fourth time and she kept falling asleep and then explained why Daniel Plainview's character was terrible. Ocean's 11 was a perfect movie. Like, it is perfectly plotted. Every performance is on point. It's endlessly entertaining, endlessly rewatchable. I would put if we're talking about like paragons of perfection amongst pop culture type films like Back to the Future, then Ocean's 11 as an adult is probably the one I would put up as being perfect.
Yeah, see, it's tough because I just want to say like Jaws and Jurassic Park are two, but I saw those movies
right
as a kid, and so like
right, you but know. Those are two great answers.
Yeah, they're great, but
yeah.
Do I think they're – I mean, I've seen Jurassic Park probably 300 times. Does that mean – like I think that probably skews my perception a bit, like the fact that I wore out a VHS copy of it within a year.
Mm. Sean, outside of the Don Cherry story on CBC, what was a perfect movie for
you?
That
was my answer.
Fuck, I'm sorry.
Yeah, my perfect movie – and again, this is – well, I was a teenager when this came out, so I think I'm kind of okay. The Fugitive. Love that movie.
Oh, that is
yeah.
a great fucking movie.
Great.
That's a good...
Had the single... Like, people kind of forget... Like, when that came out, the train wreck scene was, like, the single biggest, craziest action set piece,
right.
stunt thing that of, like, any movie that year. And... But then it, like, it uses that to, like, trick you and sucker you in and then becomes, like, a pretty smart movie with, like, great performances and an actual ending and, you know, no... sequels, like they did the offshoot with the cops, but there's no like, it doesn't end with like a question mark or something. It's just like, here's a story, beginning, middle, end. Everything's great the whole way through. It's a fantastic movie.
The ingenious thing about it too is that it's this incredible chase movie, right? And then they sort of like inject an incredible whodunit movie inside of that,
yeah,
while the chase is still happening
and also have like the, you know, the bad guy be hidden in plain sight through the movie at a time when that wasn't every movie, like now,
right.
Like in a post Sixth Sense world, every single movie has to like have the little twist of, oh my gosh, it was that guy the whole, like, but where back then you were like, oh crap, that's I can't, they're actually yeah. gonna do that.
And to link it back to Raiders, like another example of why, I mean, Harrison Ford didn't have a lot in his bag of tricks, but the dude could hold together a fucking movie like no one else.
Yeah,
like,
he's one of the greats.
Yeah, yeah. Other than that, I mean, his qualities as a movie
like
star.
One of the most charismatic actors of the late 20th century.
One thing for a movie star to be able to do, starring in a movie, is pretty high on my list.
But hold on. He's like Bogart, though. Like, or like, he's not – you can't ask him to do much outside of his lane. That's my point. Like. Yeah. Like, ever hear him try to do a fucking Russian accent?
Yeah.
Ain't good.
Well, you know what? I mean, Tommy Lee Jones is kind of similar. So you get both the guys and put them in the exact right lane. And it's fantastic.
Yeah, Tommy Lee Jones, so fucking good at being that exactly that character. I don't know that I've ever seen him be anything besides that character. Granted, I haven't seen a lot of his early work, I guess. But, like... No Country for Old Men. He plays basically the same guy.
Just older.
Yeah, just older and
right.
Men in Black, and same deal.
Men in Black is sort of like a parody of that, you know, of like if you put that character inside of a sci-fi concept. No, I agree. And I'm not trying to show – like I love Harrison Ford. I think Harrison Ford –
Sounds like you don't like him. You think he's bad.
I mean, I didn't like him when he was denying his Han Solo-ish life for a long time.
I think that's put on so that people won't fucking talk to him about it. You know what I mean? Like, because otherwise you end up being just like every question you get for your entire fucking career. And he's been in a million great movies, so it's not like – it's not – but, you know, like – I think even if it was just Indiana Jones, I don't think he's walking around going, I hate being Indiana Jones, but because
no, I think he loves being Indiana Jones. I think he's never run away from Indiana Jones.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Like, but there's not the obsessive Indiana Jones fandom like there is for Star Wars. And so if you go like, oh, I hate talking about being Han Solo, never talk to me, like that just prevents people from doing it. And you can just like go through your life.
Right. But I mean, at no point did he ever probably go to like Steven Spielberg and be like, you got to kill me after Last Crusade. I don't want to fucking do this anymore.
That's, you know, true. Like, that's true.
It probably never happened. And he was going to he wanted out after fucking Empire. That's why they froze him. They didn't know if he was going to be back. That
would have been more narratively interesting if the Carbonite had killed him, but sure.
It would also have been more narratively interesting if Lando and Yum-Nub died in the Falcon when they blow up the second Death Star, but
that's true.
You know, got to leave him. Hogan must pose, as they say. Oh, yeah, hockey. So, holy shit, they want to hold the draft in June. How about that? Before it's the season's over.
Really stupid. It's insanely dumb.
Like, the thing has been pointed out, and I think Pierre LeBrun pointed this out, but this is true. Like, when Bettman suggests things, it's not often to get negative feedback and then be like, oh, the error of my ways. It's usually to be like, here's what we're doing, get ready.
Yeah, and it's so a trial balloon,
It's a little disturbing that this might be the thing that they actually do, but I understand. I wrote about this on Thursday. Like, there are reasons to do the draft in June before the end of the season, in theory.
What
to,
are
to
they?
Get it done. Like, okay,
because
I'll
that's
tell you what
the
they
thing.
Are.
I,
that's
I'm,
a great
I'm,
question.
I'm open to doing something creative, and this is such a bizarre situation that I don't think anything should be off the table, but like, I keep looking for what we gain by doing the draft in June, other than it fills some time and we get to have some hockey to talk about when we otherwise wouldn't. That's
a primary reason, is the hey, we got nothing else going on reason. But there are other reasons. So, like, one of them is that – so if we have a truncated off season, right, like – doing the draft in June would be proper ramp up to it, proper time to research. It wouldn't be shoved into a perilously small window of like September and October, or even October before we restart the season. There's the issue of European players. So if you draft a European player in June, you've got some runway to figure out where that player is going to be next season. Could be in your minor leagues, could be on your actual roster. Who's to say? If you do it in the end of August or September, they might be already spoken for as far as what they're doing in 2020, 2021. And so you lose that opportunity to put them into your developmental program. And then Friedman pointed out that there are a lot of scouts and executives that are working the draft who currently would not have a contract for a late summer event. So their contracts are up like usually after the draft is held in June. And so he said there's one team that has like 30 guys whose contracts are up after the draft in June, like on its original date. Now, I'm sure there's probably ways to fudge those numbers and extend those deals or whatever for even in a small like window. But that's also a consideration too. So there's some issues there. All of those to me are dwarfed by the holy shit, how do we possibly seed these picks in a proper way, and holy shit, who wants to watch the NHL draft if there are no trades of players during it?
Right. Yeah, no, because that's the problem, right? It's like there are there are probably three or four guys, notable players, who would get traded. Johnny Gaudreau, probably number one, who would probably get traded at or around, you know, in the lead up to the draft, who now, well, you know, Calgary Flames are going to be in the playoffs and they can't trade Johnny Gaudreau for like futures and just not have a first line wing. So what are you going to do? And that kind of thing. Like, yeah, you know, half the fun of the draft, more than half the fun of the draft, especially after the first round, is guys getting traded. So what the fuck?
Right. And it's, but it also serves a functional thing too, like as far as the trades. I mean, obviously you're making trades to move up and down the draft board. Making trades to improve your team. But you're also usually making trades for salary cap purposes. I mean, two biggest trades that we had last year, the Subban trade and the Marlowe trade, were both completely cap driven. And if the cap's going to be flat and we're already looking at some semblance of Armageddon when it comes to these rosters, to take away the opportunity to sell off your players with picks because Yeah. You might need him for the playoffs, or you don't have the opportunity to, like, it's fucking insane to me.
Well, I guess, yeah. I mean, I take that point, and it's a valid one. The counter argument would be that holding a draft in June does nothing to say that you can't then make these trades in the off season, whenever that is. Maybe the off season's in September. You can still trade your players that you need to trade for cap reasons or for whatever else. You can still trade them for futures. You can still trade them for picks in the next draft, which in this case now would be 2021. All that you lose is the ability to trade a guy for picks and then get the pick right away and use it that day. Like, it's basically, we're making these GMs take the marshmallow test here, and they can't, like, open their presents right on Christmas Eve. They have to wait a little bit But that does matter. Like, psychologically for these guys, that there probably is a case where it's like, hey, am I going to trade this guy? I don't know, but we got this prospect we want. We think we can get him. Yeah, I'm going to pull the trigger versus if the timelines get too far out in the distance.
Right. And the other thing too is the certainty of knowing where that pick is. That's the biggest thing. Like, when you trade for a 21 – a 2021 pick, you don't know what any of those teams are going to be, but like, now you'd at least in theory know. But that's the other problem with this, is that so there's two different models that I've heard were talked about with the GMs. One is, we hold the draft in June, maybe we don't even know if we're playing again, we're just going to use points percentage from the teams at the pause and go from there, to which one of the GMs, God bless whoever it was, said, so what you're saying is there is a chance that a team could win the draft lottery and then win the Stanley Cup if we expand the playoffs, to which Bettman said, maybe, I don't know. The chances are very small. And then the other thing was, what if we do find a way to restart the regular season, which the NHL is apparently hell-bent on doing, and then hold the draft in between the end of the regular season and the beginning of the playoffs. So you take a few days, you hold the draft, you come back and start playing the championship hockey, give the boys a little bit more time to get their sea legs under them, yada, yada, yada. And then obviously have a little bit more certainty and an equitable way to figure out where these teams should draft versus, you know, the points percentage argument wherein, you know, the Winnipeg Jets could win the lottery and then get into the playoffs on an expanded playoff format and then win the cup in the same year.
Yeah, I mean, look, if somebody – like, I saw people being like, it would be unthinkable if that were – like, who gives a shit? If you win the cup and win the draft lottery, you know,
Colorado,
like, you
Colorado could have done it, what, like 2 years ago, right?
Right.
Some playoff teams do have lottery picks.
And it's not only that, it's also the idea of, like, well, you know what, if you're, like, you know, the team that was seeded 20th and you win the Stanley Cup, fucking good for you. Fucking who cares? Like, it's not like you're actually, if you were, you know, the 20th best team in the league over 75 games or whatever number they end up at, and then you know, just get on a PDO run and win the Stanley Cup. Like, that's not indicative that you're necessarily good.
Well, yeah.
And for the next season.
And how awful
this
would
it be? This impassioned defense of the 2012 LA Kings from Lambert. I had no idea you were a fan.
How awful would it be for the NHL if an elite prospect came in and was playing on a team that was actually halfway
decent right away and
didn't have to waste 3 or 4 years of their career waiting for the Red Wings to get back in the playoffs? Yeah, that would be
awful. We'd all hate
that. One of the things Bettman's talked about, by the way, is with the draft lottery. He talked about this last night as we taped the show with Ron McLean. Good to see those two hook up again.
Two old buddies.
Sean, don't you miss the interrogation sessions on Hockey Night between
Ron
McLean
and Gary
Bettman?
It's not the same when they're doing it. Like, I need Bettman to be able to reach over and awkwardly grab Ron McLean's forearm and, like, squeeze it as he's asking a question.
Right.
And you're like, dude, we can see that. Like, you know you're on camera right now. Like, it's, I
love that.
Those.
Like, Ron McLean was never better than in those sessions where he would just hold Bettman's feet to the fire about the economics or about expansion to Quebec or shit like that. Those were great. And And I felt like he was one of the few people I've ever seen really get under Gary's skin.
Oh, I did one of my YouTube breakdowns like a couple months ago on like the first time that happened. I want to say it was like the 97 All-Star game. And McClain starts asking him about like how scoring rates have dropped. And Bettman's like, well, yeah, but what about the last few weeks? What are the rates then? And McClain's like, I don't know. And he's like, yeah, they're back up. So, haha. And it's like, you're watching this literally 23 years in the future going like, that's it. Like, Gary Bettman was like, no, it's fine. We fixed it in 1997. And then, like, spiked the football and it was very proud of himself. And
classic.
But they... Oh, yeah. So anyway, one of Bettman's fixes for the draft lottery is he said they've considered reinstituting the sort of fail-safes in the lottery wherein you might be only able to move up a few spots. Remember how they used to do that? Now you win the lottery for the top three picks. It used to be you win the lottery, you could only move up a few spots. He talked about that, which to me is hilarious because the reason that they did that initially – and got rid of that was to help prevent tanking. But I guess he just looks at the Red Wings this year and he's just like, fuck it. We can't prevent
tanking.
They deserve
that. Yeah, I mean,
it's gonna happen.
Again,
yeah.
The way the draft lottery works is we all agree Detroit has the first pick, and then what?
Right.
They were so fucking bad this year. Like, worse than – and here's the thing. Up until maybe last year, they didn't think they were tanking. So –
right.
Like, it's fine. Let them have the first pick.
I don't even think they intended to tank this year.
Oh,
I don't think they knew.
Wise smarter than that.
Oh, no. I think he didn't set them up to win, but like, did they ever think they'd be this bad? I think they're the Tommy Wiseau of hockey. They set out to make a good movie, and then they made The Room. Yeah, the draft idea in June is bad, and hopefully
the draft idea thing. And if people haven't read Pierre's piece, you got to read it because I really do. I come at this with an open mind. I'm trying not to, you know, it's chaos out there. If the league wants to come at me with crazy ideas, I'll hear them out.
Now's definitely the time. Yeah, absolutely.
But I'm going through it and I'm like reading the arguments on both sides, and the arguments on both sides are terrible because like one of the first arguments for doing it that is presented is Jim Nill saying, well, like we've all these prospects are fresh in our minds right now. And if we wait until the fall, it's going to start getting all hazy.
I'm gonna
forget. dude, write it down, man. Like, make some notes or something. Like it's, you know, like we're going to get to October and like, Iserman's going to be up there like, who was the kid in the – he was French, I think. I don't know.
Al something.
Yeah, I'll take it. Yeah. But then the other argument that came up was one of the – because Pierre quotes a bunch of executives who hate the idea. And one of them is like, well, but we draft based on what happens in the playoffs. Like,
I was just going to say that. Uh-huh. Like, the number of GMs whose jobs are going to be saved by this stupid draft because they don't fucking blow it, or they do blow it, but they get to go, yeah. Well, look, I didn't get to see those four extra Memorial Cup games.
Like, we didn't
what am
have,
I supposed to do?
We didn't have enough defensive depth in round two, and that's why we lost game seven. So I'm going to draft an 18-year-old who won't play for five years.
And then the other thing, of course, is like they're going to go, well, look, what were you supposed to do? We thought we were going to be in a position to pick fifth, but they moved all the rules around for the lottery. We picked seventh. How did we know? Like, it's going to be so many fucking excuses. And it's all, again, as we've said it a million times, to make GMs go, look, sure, I did a bad job, but there are reasons that I did a bad job that you didn't think about. And they're just going to trot out every conceivable one now.
Right. And then also we're on a 5-year plan, so you have to let me build up our cover and stuff.
And
this year didn't count.
It's a freebie.
The reason the NHL draft to me has never resonated on the level like other drafts have, and I think baseball has the same problem. So I'm basically saying not like the NBA or the NFL is that very issue is the immediacy. Like if the Jets suck last year, the New York Jets, and it's because of their offensive line and because they don't have a deep threat receiver, they go into the draft this week and they're like, okay, if there's an O lineman, we're going to take him. He's going to play next season. Yep. Or if there's a wide receiver, we're going to take him. He's going to play like next season.
The NFL draft is the best. Like that.
Without question.
Not even the first round. Like the teams tonight are going to, well, not tonight, but this weekend, will pick guys in like round four that will start for them.
Yes.
And it's you know, and the NBA, you get that for like the first 10 picks, and then it sort of can be all over the map. Whereas the NFL is just like seven rounds of this guy could start or he might never even make the team, and we're not really sure. And you're right. Like, baseball is the worst out of the group because
baseball's
you
the never, worst.
Like, you have guys that are like the Connor McDavid of baseball prospects, and they still.
And he's not on a major league roster for six years.
You won't see them for years and years. And the NHL is, you know, it can have, especially the last few years, it seems to be moving back towards guys making the league right away, but. It's certainly you're not seeing anyone.
It's still only
you're not
like
seeing
five
any day
guys
two guys that,
do it. That
are yeah it's,
yeah. And also, I think the other deal is that, like, even though for a lot of Americans, you know, we're not necessarily watching these kids in like the Memorial Cup and stuff like that as much as Canadian fans are. I mean, I still think that there is much more of a recognition of who they are and what they do, and watching them in World Junior and things like that. Like, baseball prospects, like. Unless you're watching, you know, Oklahoma versus Nebraska on ESPN 10, during the regular season, like, who the fuck are these kids? No one knows.
Yeah.
So at the very least, hockey has that going for it. I just wish that there was that more immediate help aspect of it, outside of the top five guys, that would make it even more compelling.
Well, Christ, the way the cap's going, you know,
it could be.
they're going to have to bring
labor.
In a lot of guys on ELCs. So.
The other big holy shit news in the last couple of days, holy shit, they went from trying to play games in North Dakota to trying to play games in four different NHL arenas. So goodbye, neutral site game. Neutral site games, by the way, I was talking to somebody with the league yesterday, and they're like, it really never was going to be a thing.
No.
It never really got off the drawing board. And I'm like, well, you know, I literally said, thanks for the content. Like, thanks for not popping those balloons so quickly. So we had a good run of, you know, waiting for Chris Sununu to tell us why Manchester, New Hampshire is petition. Oh, the best thing I heard this week, by the way, and I can't tell you where I heard it from, but it's fantastic. Apparently, there was a Residence Inn in Manchester, New Hampshire, that upon hearing that the NHL may have been considering holding games in New Hampshire, called the league and offered up blocks of rooms in the Residence Inn like it was a wedding to NHL teams so they could put their players in the Residence Inn. That is the greatest thing I've heard this week. And kudos to the Residence Inn, man. Like, if you
they're going
obviously
for
the
it.
The Lipschitz wedding's not happening. You know, it's quarantined. But if you can get blocks of NHL teams at the wedding rate,
I'm trying to think that might be the one that's like right next to the arena too. That would have been great for everybody involved.
Yeah. So that was hella aggressive. But yeah, no hoisting the Stanley Cup in Grand Forks or Manchester or Saskatoon.
Instead,
or
it'll be an empty arena that looks exactly the same, but it will be closer to an NHL market. Like, that's the thing.
Right.
Like, this,
that's
like,
right.
Oh, we're not going to do neutral. Like, dude, if you put it in an empty arena in Edmonton, that is still a neutral site game. Like, there's no, the Oilers aren't gaining some huge advantage other than, you know, maybe being able to see their families, but they're not like, if it's going to be empty arenas, it really does, purely from a fan's perspective. I know the logistics and organizing it and everything is a huge challenge, but just from a fan's perspective, one empty arena is going to look pretty much the same as any other, unless they let the Oilers like decorate it however they want. That might be cool if they.
Yeah, that was why I was excited about the college arenas, is because they were a little bit smaller. You could have maybe controlled the lighting better. You could have controlled the aesthetics better. But I mean, at the end of the day, the NHL is right in the sense that, like, you still have to make room for all that staff and multiple teams. You have to have a practice facility in order to have multiple teams on site to be able to practice while the games are going on, because you're going to structure them like you do the World Cup or you know, international tournaments, where you're going to have like three games a day. And then you have to have the facilities for the broadcast partners too, because you're going to have multiple national TV, local TV, local radio, like those people.
I was wondering if they would do that by like
there too.
Having them like they used to do for soccer on ESPN or whatever, and just have them call it from a booth like in Toronto or in.
Now, my favorite call it from a booth thing of all time was, do you remember during this? This I think this was. It had to have been the 2013 lockout.
Yeah.
Because I don't think was the KHL around during the initial. The season. I don't think it
was. You're thinking of the Barry Melrose calling.
Yeah,
like,
Barry Melrose and Steve Levy calling KHL games from Bristol.
Yeah. That was something, man. I remember. I watched that first one and I was like, I don't think I could do this anymore.
It was basically like them trying to call the game, but every 2 seconds it would be them stopping to make fun of some guy's name.
Yes.
That's fucking
good tremendous. Shit.
Good shit. Yeah, no, I to me, like, you have a good point, which is that you know the national TV people are going to be there, but the local radio guys might have to just, like, get together in some guy's basement and watch it off the TV. Well,
but that's what I'm saying. Like, why do the national TV people have to be there?
Yeah, like, in Canada, we've had broadcasts done that way. So I don't even know. I mean, I guess... Yeah, maybe the real big national guys, but do you?
Who cares?
You don't need them, but they're paying so much money that they'll be there, like, without question. Batman said something interesting last night too, which is that he said that, like, they basically have all their money from the broadcast partners. So if the playoffs don't happen, then it would be credits against the money that they're owed for next season,
right?
Which has got to be fucking brutal. So. You know, the fulfilling the broadcast obligations part of this financial equation of potentially throwing your players into the middle of a pandemic just to get them back on the ice is part of this equation too. Mm-hmm.
And we should say everybody now is 100% convinced that this is going to happen. Like, no, nobody's like, well, maybe. Everybody you talk to is like, yeah, of course they're going to play these games in like July or August. 100%.
Yeah. Right.
So that's
which
it.
Which again... It's a little insane because you still have to have the NHLPA sign off on it. And, you know, we talked to Don Fehr a couple weeks ago and he's just like, yeah, you got to have testing. You got to be able to isolate. You got to be able to do all these things to keep our guys safe. Now, at the end of the day, he's saying that, but is the totality of the NHLPA saying that is the question? Like, do these guys actually give a shit about coming back and getting tested? Or do they just want to play for the cup? Because that's the...
Well,
no one can accuse NHL players of
not want to have a 40% pay cut.
Correct.
Like, that's part of it too.
And again, like you are literally talking about people who, by and large, will always put their own health and safety at risk to achieve on ice success or financial success or whatever drives them. So it's hard for me to square the idea that these guys are going to be like, nah, I can't come back during this pandemic. Yeah. I might get sick. When they you know have allow people to elbow them in the head.
Yeah, but you know what? You don't like that bad shoulder. You don't bring that home and give the bad shoulder to your family and spread it around your community. Like I do think that for at least some of these guys, the calculus is going to change a bit. From you know, I can grit my teeth and play through my bad ankle, but do I want to risk? Again, not just my health, but potentially everyone around me.
Yeah, the only people who are going to be willing to have coronavirus are the ones who are like, well, you know, the last 5 years of this contract, I'm only getting paid $1 million a year, so I'm going to maybe, yeah, it's fine, I'll get coronavirus. Take the hit.
I think you're going to end up. Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say, like Ryan says, like it is true that it feels like we've suddenly developed this consensus that this is going to happen. But there's still a lot of time between now and whenever they'd start up. It's not going to take much more than, you know, a flare up here or we learn something new there to change the decision making again. So I know hockey fans out there are, you know, we all want to see hockey again under the right circumstances. And if it sounds like they're moving towards something that could pass as that, then that's good news. But there's still a ways to go before we get there, and I'm even as much as it feels like a sure thing now, I'm not convinced that it's going to still feel that way not too far down the road.
I do find it interesting that much like every other issue that sits before the NHLPA, this one's going to be completely drawn down the age lines. You know, like older players with families, with, you know, older parents – are probably going to be like, I don't know, man. I'd like to get tested and kind of sit in isolation to make sure that I don't bring this home to my family. 21-year-old guys that live alone and just have been playing Call of Duty for the last 2 months. They're just like, let's fucking go.
Could be, yeah.
You know? I guarantee you. But yeah, like Sean said, I mean, there's no determining any of this until we know about local and federal restrictions on travel, on mass gatherings, on essential businesses. You could start yelling about this stuff until, you know, you're blue in the face or blue in the tooth. And speaking of Bluetooth, today's episode of Puck Soup is sponsored by Raycon.
Jesus Christ, man.
Yeah. You look around, boys. It's a wireless world, and everyone needs a great pair of wireless earbuds. So before you go dropping hundreds of dollars on a pair, you need to check out the wireless earbuds from Raycon. You know Raycon earbuds. We've talked about them on the show before. Their latest model, the E25, is their best one yet. With 6 hours of playtime, seamless Bluetooth pairing, more bass, and a more compact design that gives you a nice noise-isolating fit. We have talked about the fit before on this show as well. I love these earbuds. They're the only ones I use when I'm working out. I have unfortunately had to become a jogger because my gym is closed. I hate running, but I like running with the Raycon earbuds because they don't fall out and because the sound is always really solid. I have maybe weird ears where some of the other Bluetooth options don't fit very well and fall out of my ears. Not these Raycon ones. They're really good. And the sound quality is awesome. And this is one of those rare products where we've multiple people on the show have used them and liked them as well. Yeah.
I've heard good things. My wife still hasn't given them back, which I guess is as strong an endorsement as you could have.
Mark of quality. Absolutely. The company was co-founded by Ray J. Celebrities like Snoop Dogg and Cardi B are obsessed with their Raycons. You will be too. Now is the time to get the latest and greatest from Raycon, especially because we're all stuck inside. If we're not stuck inside, we're outside. Maybe we want to just stick some earbuds in our ears and not have to worry about anybody. Get 15% off your order at buyraycon.com. So that's buyraycon.com/puck. Don't forget about the slash puck. Buyraycon.com/puck for 15% off Raycon wireless earbuds. Again, strongest endorsement that Puck Soup can give to a product. We give it to the Raycon E25 earbuds. They are fantastic and they are affordable. And hopefully you grab them at buyraycon.com/puck. Two other NHL items before we get to the crux of the show. The Bruins reunion. Lambert, you were sour on it.
It's fine. I'm sure it was entertaining. What I didn't need was half the NHL media being like, Brad Marchand just said Patrice Bergeron smells bad. Can you fucking believe this shit? It's like, yeah, no, I mean, it's guys shooting the shit. I can indeed believe it. But the pointlessness of live tweeting a Zoom call was trumped just 48 hours later by people live tweeting the Alex Ovechkin's Wayne Gretzky
NHL 20 matchup.
Look, I joked that it was a new low for hockey journalism to be live tweeting the Bruins Zoom call. I earnestly believe that people be like, Gretzky scores on a wrist shot to go up 2-1 is like the saddest shit I've ever seen in my fucking life. Like, get a grip.
It's still better than doing the prospect games.
Still, and also live tweeting practice.
Practice, yeah.
Still better than that too.
I the thing I always say about that is, look, everybody, it's part of everybody's job, right? Like, you know, if you're the guy who does the Bruins for whatever, like one the Athletic,
Nesson,
yeah. You have to be like, here's what's going on with the Bruins every single day. But my thing is and always has been, at the start of the season, you sit down, you figure out, okay, Fluto's going to tweet about practice this day. Joe Haggerty's going to do it the next day. And Matt Porter is the day after that. Just go down the list like that. So entire feeds are not people just going, goal by Patrice Bergeron. Like, yeah, no, we know.
Yep.
Yeah.
Eight updates telling me which goal each goalie just went to. Like they're cracking a mystery. Right. Like, ooh, he's in the starter's net. That could indicate.
Just nail it down.
Yeah, right.
Just nail it down before the season, and then that way everybody's life is 5% easier. Because then, like, you know, if it's Fluto's day, Matt Porter doesn't have to do it, and his and he can just do other stuff that day and like actually work. Wow, crazy.
I feel like it's always Fluto's day, like Rusev Day. R.I.P. By the way.
R.I.P. What a king.
So the Gretzky Ovechkin thing did raise like $40K, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, great.
And I did love the video of Ovechkin celebrating his own goal, like he had just scored it on the ice, which was fucking great. And honestly, without question, a glimpse into the life of Alex Ovechkin that we rarely ever get, because whether it's a Call of Duty kill or whatever, that is definitely the fucking reaction.
DM me last night because I made fun of the Gretzky thing. And he goes, you do need to watch part of it because every time a goalie made a routine save, Gretzky said something along the lines of, man, this goalie is too good. And it's like, boy, that's not a perfect fucking encapsulation.
Oh, it's tremendous. The Bruins call I loved. I was so incredibly entertained by the Bruins call for two reasons. One, it never clicked before to me, and I know this is blasphemy to Boston fans, that they remind me very much of the 86 Mets. Like, they are just this – there's a few couple like, Hall of Fame types, a lot of really good players in their prime on that 2011 team, and then just, like, a slew of knuckleheads – that played important roles in that team. And I love that team. And it's very hard for me to love anything from Boston as a New York sports fan. I mean, obviously. But I do genuinely love that team. That might be my favorite cup-winning team as far as a collection of guys and how they played and, you know, the perfect foil for a Vancouver team that had a bunch of deplorable people on it. It was really fun to see that group together again. And then the other thing was, it was like being at a class reunion and seeing everybody kind of just drop back into their roles that they played when they were like seniors, in the sense that you have two guys on that call with big personalities in Tyler Seguin and Brad Marchand. And like Seguin was quiet the entire time because he's 19 again. And Marchand was just getting fucking pummeled by other guys with chirps without really giving it back because he's 22 again.
But
on
here's
that call.
The other
it
thing.
It was fucking fantastic.
Here's the other thing that did, and this is going to be a very old man take. I recognize that right up front. But I think part of the reason Tyler Seguin was quiet is because Tyler Seguin plays for the Dallas Stars. Like, he's doing a Bruins thing, but he's not a Bruin anymore. And I think there's this element of it where it's like, hey, I was part of this team. I love it. But also, like, I'm on another team right now. I can't be versus like, it cracks me up how Milan Lucic is just like fully embracing his like, I think he just for the night is still a Boston Bruin. I think he's just like, right. I never went to the Kings. I never went to the Oilers. I never left. He is just Bruin. Like, he's more Boston Bruin in these things than like half the guys who are still on the Boston Bruins. And it's a very interesting dynamic to me to see this guy who, like, very clearly, he's like, you know, you mentioned it's like a high school reunion. Like, he's the guy who was cool in high school and it just didn't work out. And this is his night to be that guy again.
Yes.
Yep. Absolutely.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's a really good point. And in some ways, Seguin is kind of like that nerd in high school who became like a dot-com billionaire, right?
He's like high school was fine, but I've gone on and done other things.
Right,
and
I've moved on to bigger, better things. And plus, he's probably got some of that nerd rage, too, because of the way the Bruins treated him and fucking traded him. Like, he didn't want to leave Boston, but they made the decision to fucking deal him. So he's probably on that call also thinking, not only am I somewhere else, not only am I, you know, making close to $10 million a season and have moved beyond this team from being like a child grunt on this team to being a superstar in my own right, I'm also contributing to the Zoom call for an organization that fucking treated me like dog
remember
shit.
Remember that time I was late for one class and I got expelled? Yeah, I don't really want to hang out here that much.
I think he was late for one class and then they stuck a truant officer at his door for the rest of the season. Yep.
The Kamala Harris method, we call that.
Wow. But it was really funny and hearing Puck Soup favorite Gregory Campbell chirping Marchand with double barrels about his hairline and then also how shitty his clothing line is. The line of, you make $60 million, you don't have to do this. It's just fucking – it's tremendous. It was a tremendously entertaining call, and I was happy to witness it. Although the part where this is a part that no one's really talked about because it was so fucking strange. There's a part where Tuukka Rask openly wished that his daughter grew a cock, is what he said, so he would have a son. It's literally a joke that he made on the call.
Okay.
Cool.
But I think people were so aghast by it, they didn't really know how to process it. Which, again, is very much high school class reunion. There's always that friend of yours that says the inappropriate thing and you don't know how to process it, so you just kind of continue the conversation.
He still remembers, like, 2 weeks ago when Zdeno Chara said that he farts too much, and he was like, oh, if I ever get the chance, I too will say something borderline right. inappropriate, and people will laugh. Right. And then sometimes you overshoot the runway. It's
that's his jerk store comment. Yeah. Right. He's been waiting to just drop that. The other hockey thing is Gerard Gallant interviewed with the Devils. The Devils have apparently have been talking to other coaches as well. Alain Nezradine had to do the classic. Who was it? Joe Sacco, who was the coach of the Avalanche when they were openly courting Patrick Waugh
yes.
to be the coach, had to do the Joe Sacco thing of being like, I'm the coach until someone tells me I'm not, during a conference call yesterday, which is really emasculating. As a Devils fan, I like Gerard Gallant as a coach. I don't know if I like him as the coach of a rebuilding Devils team, to be quite candid with you.
Yeah, I think that's – look, it's one of those things where – I don't know. Go out and get the best possible coach you can, and figure it out from there. I guess I'm not going to knock the Devils for looking at a coach who's good because they tried it with this guy's really good at bringing along the young talent and blah blah blah. And yeah, how'd that fucking work out, right?
No. So, and Gerard Gallant has had some success with younger guys, and he had some of those young guys in Florida that have turned out pretty well. But yeah, you're right. When you say like, oh, they're rebuilding. To me, if you're rebuilding, you don't stay away from Gerard Gallant because you think he's not going to help your young guys develop or whatever. You stay away from him if your plan for rebuilding is to finish last for the next couple of years and get a few more high draft picks. But I don't think that should be your plan because you've got two number one picks. You've got two guys who are going into their prime. Those are your guys to build around. You want to be better than people think you're going to be. And Gerard Gallant is the number one coach as far as
excellent
making
coach.
Teams better than we thought they would be. He's the guy. So, go grab him if he's available.
The other thing to say about that is, let's go get this. Let's stick with Alain Nezradine. Let's get this guy who's like a really good development guy in the AHL or something. And then 4 years from now, you're like, fuck, we need a coach that can bring this team from rebuilding to being good. I hope someone as good as Gerard Gallant is available.
Yeah, mm-hmm. it's the Jeff Gorton, Artemi Panarin line, which is like, we might not be ready to have Artemi Panarin on this team, but there's not going to be an Artemi Panarin around.
That's right.
When we need him. Yeah, so just get him now. I mean, that's a fair point. And, there's obviously, like, other coaches, Laviolette being one of them, that are out there that I think are intriguing as well. If you were Gallant and you were offered these three options, which one do you take? Dallas, Detroit, Jersey.
I mean, I just from a team perspective, I take Dallas. But if I had the history in Detroit and I the relationship with Steve Yzerman, and I'm assuming both of those are good, that which maybe isn't not an assumption I should make, but I'm assuming he liked it in Detroit. I'm assuming he gets along well with Yzerman. That's probably the situation that feels a little too tailor-made to pass up on.
In Dallas, you have an owner that spends. You have a GM that really hasn't necessarily proven that he could build a championship team quite yet. They're very good, but they're just not a championship-level team. You have a couple of specious contracts, which we'll get into. In Jersey, you've got two guys to build around, but who knows about one of them in the sense of what Hughes will end up being, center, wing, good, average, who the fuck knows. And then you have meddlesome ownership, and you don't know who your GM is. And then in Detroit, you've got incredible ownership and arguably the best GM in hockey. So I think I would pick Detroit just because of where the bar is set, and also because to work with Iserman would be my choice.
But then, I mean, you know, if you go to the Red, this is the only thing, because on its face, the Red Wings is the right answer. But if you go to the Red Wings, you're going to have to deal with some really bad players for 3-4 more years. And granted, like, you know, 3 years from now, you can hide Justin Abdelkader at the bottom of the lineup or even scratch him on a pretty regular basis. But, like, he's signed for 4 more, I want to say. Franz Nielsen signed for two more after this one. The good news is, like, the Red Wings are about to turn over, if I'm remembering right, like, 90% of their roster. I think everybody is either an RFA or a UFA except for, like, 6 or 7 guys maybe.
Yeah.
And so, like,
they got a ton of picks.
They picked high already. You know, I think that's a good position to be in, but, you know, just there are a bunch of guys where, you know, you're going to have to be like, well, the veterans have to get their playing time, and you're also going like, but the veterans are fucking bad. So, like, I think that's not an ideal situation for a coach, but I guess it's better than, you know, like you said, going to New Jersey and who knows what you have here.
Mm-hmm. All right. All right, now it's time for the crux of the show. Sean, as per usual, had an incredible idea that we'll just steal and, you know, repropagate for the show. It's salary cap court. Or do you like contract court? Which do you prefer, Sean?
I think I called it salary cap court because at the end of the day, I think fans don't really – we don't care about somebody's contract in the sense of, you know, how many dollars are actually going in their pocket. It's the cap that we're worried about. That matters when you're if you're a baseball fan or you cheer for a team that it doesn't have a cap, it shouldn't really matter. You should just want the players to get as much money as possible.
Only we had a luxury tax.
In a cap world, you got to worry about, you know, what's the cap, how many years are left. So the concept here was that and this is something I've done a couple of times at the Athletic, and we pick some new players. The idea here is, you take a contract, and none of these contracts are good. And with the obvious disclaimer, we're saying good and bad from the perspective of the team. Okay? So is this a good contract for such and such a team? No. None of these contracts are what we would call good. But they are there is, to me, a difference between a contract that's a little dicey and a contract that is capital B bad. You know, Brent Seabrook has a bad contract. There's other guys where there's no debate. It's a bad contract. Some of these guys are a little borderline. So we're going to kind of make the case on both sides, and then we'll figure out, is this an actual bad contract, or is it maybe just one that's not perfect, but we can let it slide?
All right. Let's begin.
And the idea here is we are looking at the contract going forward. That's all we care about. If there were a few years earlier on where it looked good, that's in the past. We don't care about that. This is from this day forward.
Well,
what's left of the contract, good or not?
I appreciate that. As someone who's going to have to be a defense attorney here, I feel that's divorcing some context from some of these as far as why their contracts were signed.
Well, you can have the context of why they were signed, but we're not going back to litigate, should this have been signed 6 years ago? It's starting, right, you know, from today, when you're looking and saying which teams have bad contracts, you know, the fact if your cap situation is screwed, but it was in good shape 4 years ago, that doesn't really matter.
All right. The first one we're going to talk about is Brent Burns of the San Jose Sharks, an alternate captain, right defense, signed a contract on November 22nd, 2016. For 8 years and $64 million. That's a $8 million cap hit through 2025. Limited no trade protection throughout the contract. And we begin with Constable Ryan Lambert for the prosecution.
So the argument against the Brent Burns contract is very simple. He was 32 years old when it began. It's 8 years long, and it has an AAV of $8 million. It also has one of the most limited no-trade clauses you can possibly have, because he submits a list of just 3 teams he can be traded to every summer. So he signed it 3 years ago. He's 35 now, and yet he's signed for another 5 seasons. It's a classic case of a team having an elite player on the wrong side of 30, and rather than accepting that it should trade him or let him walk, it decided to do whatever it whatever we got to do to retain him, and even if that means signing you until you're 40, right? In doing so, Doug Wilson gambled that Brent Burns would continue to be roughly an $8 million player on average over the life of the deal, but that means maybe getting more than that value over the first 2, 3, maybe 4 years. Hasn't worked out that way. In the first 3 years, Brent Burns, among defensemen, has ranked 2nd, 2nd, and 7th by AAV. By wins above replacement, 260th, 16th, and 54th. For a combined $30 million in salary and bonuses, the Sharks got less than 3 wins above replacement over 3 seasons, and that's about the same as defensemen like, say, Carl Gunnarsson and Mark Pisick. You know, that's just me picking 2 totally random names. You can talk about the value of Burns' offense, and clearly, like, that's why they gave him all this money, right? But the fact is he really only gets that because he takes a million shots. Mm. But what you got to think about is this. A shot from the blue line is significantly less valuable, that is, like, less likely to go in the net, than one from below the circles. And that's not where Brent Burns shoots from. He's firing away from the blue line, and in doing so, possibly costing the Sharks value in terms of on a per-shot basis, instead of if he had deferred to one of the many very highly talented teammates he's had over the last 3 years. And the other thing to say about it is this. He signed this deal coming off 2 seasons where he scored a combined 56 goals every time he shot the puck. He scored 56 goals. But that's because he shot the puck 4.1 times per game and had an 8.3 shooting percentage over 2 seasons. Since this deal went into effect, he shot the puck 3.7 times per game and, more importantly, had a shooting percentage of 4.7. So we're supposed to look at these last 3. These were supposed to be the good years where he was supposed to provide excess value. Now he's 35. He's not going to get any better. The Sharks don't seem like they're going to get any better anytime soon. And that's in large part, albeit not entirely, because the Burns deal was bad on day one.
I should mention that one of us is going to be the prosecutor, one of us is the defense attorney, and one of us is the judge, just to set the thing.
Yeah, and we did mix it around. Ryan's not going to be the prosecutor on all 6 guys.
Yeah, we're all doing every job twice.
Yeah, that was a pretty strong case.
Thank you.
Your Honor.
Case for the defense?
Your Honor, while my friend across the aisle has spent copious amounts of time arguing why defensemen shouldn't shoot the puck, news to the great Ray Bourque and Nick Lidstrom, I imagine, who I don't think necessarily were shooting from the circles. I have to say that Brent Burns' unparalleled ability to pump shots on goal makes this contract worthy of admiration. I mean, in the previous 3 seasons before, admittedly, a very disastrous year for the Sharks, in which, I'll remind you, they had to fire their coach. Brent Burns had a 0.92 points per game average and 952 shots on goal. Your Honor, I would argue those are outstanding numbers. In fact, he's only 2 years removed from being a Norris Trophy finalist. We are to look at the numbers this season and say that Brent Burns is somehow over the hill. We're to look at Brent Burns' numbers this season and somehow say that he is no longer a player that can play on an elite level. I defy you to say that about a man who was a Norris Trophy finalist, but 2 years ago. The contract itself, while on the surface may not look good, is essentially a 5 to 6 year deal at $8 million AAV. His salary drops to $6.5 million base in 2020-2023, then down to $5 million the following season. I recognize the fact that this contract does contain draconian trade protection, but I will argue that a man who owns as many snakes as Brent Burns does will eventually want to go play somewhere where there's more, like, woods and shit
Compare his contract to Eric Carlson's, and I would argue Brent Burns is not overpaid, but rather one of the greatest bargains in the National Hockey League. The defense rests.
Wow. Geez, you know what? You guys both making good cases here. And I want to point out that you both seem to have put more thought into your cases than I did in any of mine. So apologies in advance to any of the players that I'm supposed to be representing. Boy, this one is a tough one. And I got a rule. I got to give a guilty or non-guilty here. It's, and I'm impressed with both sides of the argument.
Before you rule.
Yeah.
Just keep in mind, a man's life hangs in the balance.
Oh, yeah. I know, we should say, if any of these guys are found guilty, they're going to be executed.
They get executed. Yeah.
And I do still hold a personal grudge against Brent Burns because one time after an All-Star game, I was in an airport and I ended up sitting across from him and his family, including two very young children, while waiting for a delayed flight for several hours. And both of his kids were like immaculately well behaved, and it just drove me insane because I'm sitting there going, if my kids were here, they would be crawling everywhere, and they were both just like sitting and politely reading books and stuff. And so I'm still holding a bit of a grudge. I am going to say, while I did appreciate the arguments on both sides, this guy is 35 and there's 5 years left on this deal. I think this is a bad contract. I think this is one of those where you could argue that maybe on balance overall, it looks a little bit better because he did have a couple of good years at the beginning, but we're talking his 35 to 40 seasons on a guy with a lot of mileage who's already showing signs of significant decline. I don't like these next 5 years. I wouldn't like him if San Jose was looking like a cup contender. I definitely don't like them on a team that is going to struggle. I'm saying bad contract.
I don't like that, but we'll move on.
All right, the next
take
one
him away.
Is
take them away, toys.
The next one is Tyler Seguin with Greg saying it's a bad contract and Sean saying it's fine.
$48.5 million. What does that number mean to you, Your Honor? Well,
can I plea bargain?
Just to get up from under this shit.
Talk him down to substandard contract.
$48.5 million of the $78.8 million that Tyler Seguin makes on his contract with the Dallas Stars will be paid in the first 4 years. The first full year of that contract is this year, Your Honor. And what do we find? Tyler Seguin literally shitting the bed. The kind of shit that you don't even try to wash the sheets. You try to just... Yeah, literally. Don't fucking talk. It's not your turn to talk. Objection, Your Honor. He can't fucking talk.
That's true.
Strike literally.
I withdraw.
Shitting the bed. The kind of shit where you don't even try to wash the sheets. You just throw the sheets away and then go back to Target and get new sheets. And that's in the first year of this contract. His worst offensive number since 2012-13. Uh-oh. Maybe giving him $48.5 million of his deal in the first 4 years was not the motivating factor you thought it would be. Only three centers have made more than his $13.5 million base salary this season. Three. Is Tyler Seguin the fourth best center in the National Hockey League? That's absurd. That's crazy talk. And hey, I thought Texas was a tax-free state, buddy. Why do you need $13.5 million base salary at any point during this contract to Tyler Seguin? So, overrated, tattooed pretty boy, bad contract.
Yeah, I don't know. That's pretty convincing. All right. Here's the thing with Tyler Seguin. Yes, this year was not a good season for him. He did not have the level of production that we're used to. But the level of production we're used to with Tyler Seguin in the previous six seasons, he's been one of the most consistent players in the NHL. He's been between 70 and 80-something points for six straight years. Now, is this year the start of a decline, or is this year a weird outlier? I would argue we can kind of write this year off. It was a very strange year in Dallas. There was some weird stuff going on. The coaching change, the team starting off poorly, getting hot. This is one of those years where I think you're going to look back and say, this maybe wasn't representative of everything that this team could be, let alone the individual players. Tyler Seguin's 28 years old. If this guy was 32, then yes, one bad season does raise all sorts of alarm bells. But when a guy's 28 and you're talking, unlike a lot of the guys that we're talking about in this cap court thing, where we're going to be looking at guys who signed contracts on the wrong side of 30, getting rewarded for the past instead of what they can do in the future. Tyler Seguin signed this deal when he was 26. He's 28 now. He's not in his prime as we know it for forwards, but he's not far removed, and he should be a fairly productive player for most of the life of this deal. You look at the comparables. Yeah, you can look at the number, but it's the cap hit percentage that you want to look at. If a guy signs a contract 2 years after somebody else, of course the cap number is going to be higher. He comes in under guys like Anze Kopitar. He comes in under John Tavares, under Evgeny Malkin, way under Jonathan Toews. He comes in, the closest comparable for him is Steven Stamkos, who was a guy who we all acknowledge took a bit of a discount to stay in Tampa. And is probably not a bad comparison as far as being a guy who's not in that conversation of being the very best centers in the game, but it's probably down in the next tier, a guy who's a number one center on most teams in the league. I think right now, 9 and change for a number one center is not awful. And I think over the life of this deal, assuming Tyler Seguin can come back to being a consistent 70, 80-point guy, it's going to look better and better as more guys sign. I don't love the deal. I'm not going to sit here and say it's some sort of discount or a steal, but I don't think it deserves to be considered a bad contract in the same breath as some of the truly awful deals that are out there.
I have to say that I tend to agree with Sean on this one. It's a situation where I think this could become a bad contract. I all this stuff about, he's getting all this money up front. Like, who gives a shit? It doesn't matter because it's about the AAV. Mm. And so, you know, I think this could become a bad contract in the last 3-4 years. And obviously the fact that there's a no movement clause is not ideal. But, yeah, I mean, when this deal expires, he's going to be 35, 36 years old. And that's... He's going to be up there, but, you know, he can be productive till he's 33. And if you're only dealing with the last 2 or 3 years being kind of onerous at a time when the cap will be probably, hopefully for the league, significantly higher, I tend to think that this is not a bad contract yet, but it certainly has that potential.
So your ruling?
My ruling is that Sean is correct.
Man, I'm like a fucking public defender over here, just taking L's. All right, next contract is the Matt Duchene contract that he signed with the Nashville Predators last year. Matt Duchene, for those who don't know, 29-year-old center, 7 years, $56 million, 9.82% of the cap. It's me again on the prosecution and Ryan on the defense. Your Honor, David Poile hates giving out trade protection on his contracts, yet he did so for Matt Duchene, but only for the part of the deal where you don't want someone to have trade protection. Nothing like a 34-year-old center with a bunch of miles on those tires with a no-trade clause. But my biggest problem with this contract, simple. Matt Duchene isn't a star. He's not excellent. He's not a top five player. Matt Duchene is and always shall be pretty okay. His best offensive season, Your Honor, was when he was singing for a supper for this very contract. Now that he has it, what will come from Matt Duchene? And I argue, Your Honor, that at 29, what will come are diminishing returns through 2026. Your witness.
So a lot of the sticker shock on the Matt Duchene contract boils down to context. Wow, you might say. An AAV of $8 million sure is a lot. And it is in certain respects. But most of these respects do boil down to that context. He entered the season tied with his teammate Ryan Johansson and the Sharks' Logan Couture with the 14th highest cap hit among centers in the league. That, however, lined up more or less with his position among centers in wins above replacement over the last three seasons. The last season, he put up 3.2 wins above replacement. That's comparable to elite center Nathan MacKinnon and elite scoring wingers Johnny Gaudreau and Brad Marchand. Keep in mind, he did that, though, with the Ottawa fucking Senators, a terrible team. And he was one of maybe, what, three offensive weapons on that team where, you know, a team could the other team could really hone in on his line and try to shut them down. And he scored like crazy. More to the point, though, is that $8 million now is less than 10% of the salary cap, and it's basically the cost of a typical waiver pickup plus whatever Kevin Hayes, who's 14 months younger, got from the Flyers this summer. So even if we're not counting Duchene's hot hand in Ottawa last year, this is a guy who's been remarkably consistent production-wise throughout his career. 0.74 points per game over all 11 seasons of his career. But only two of them have seen him dip below 0.64 points per game, and neither of those have happened since 2014. By contrast, Kevin Hayes' high in points per game is 0.77, and his average is worse than all but those two low-scoring Duchene seasons. So, put simply, just because a contract isn't an incredible value doesn't mean it's bad. The market bears what it bears, and this summer we saw what, you know, top six forwards get. The market for Duchene was that this AAV was never going to be a steal, but it doesn't have to be a steal. It just has to be fair. And if that's the market rate for a guy who's going to be this productive for, you know, based on his age, he can be productive. He'll be a little more than 35 years old when this deal ends. And, you know, that trade protection that Greg talked about, oh, you don't want – it's only seven teams that he can say no to. So the idea that, like, you're not going to be able to do anything with him if you need to trade him at the end of this deal, I don't agree with that. I don't buy that. So I think this is a perfectly reasonable contract for a player who – you know, he, like Greg said, he's not a star, but he's only the 14th highest paid center in the league right now, and that number is going to keep going down. So I think for a guy who's like a low-end one, you know, the Preds did as well as they could have.
All right. I feel like we should point out that I want each of these cases to be viewed as like an independent on its own thing, because
legal precedent.
Yeah, well, because a lot of what Ryan just said is very similar to what I argued for Tyler Seguin. So in theory, I should be very accepting of that argument, lest I reveal myself to be a hypocrite who was saying things he didn't believe about my last case. But I'm going to say for a couple of reasons, I think this is a bad contract. And the reason I say that is first of all, I don't give a lot of I acknowledge that when you sign guys in UFA, you're going to pay a premium. But as I argued when I went through this exercise with John Tavares in one of the columns I wrote last week, I'm not sure that should really affect our thinking that much. I mean, if you go to what you know is the most expensive car lot in town to buy your car. Mm-hmm. And you overpay, you still overpaid. You know, it may have been the only place you could have gone, but you still overpaid. And I look at Matt Duchene as a guy who is at that age where, yeah, you know, this isn't Tyler Seguin having a bad year in year one of a contract, but he's been consistently productive in a 70-80 point range the entire rest of his career. This is Matt Duchene who has peaked as a 70 point player, comes in, signs a big deal, and tops out at like 40-something in year one. That worries me. I don't think he is a number one center. I think he's one of those guys who, if he hadn't been the third overall pick in a draft, we probably wouldn't, we would probably view him as like a solid number two, real good number three. And he's getting paid to be a number one by a team that was desperate for a number one, but I don't think he is. And so that's the main reason I'm going to rule that it's a bad contract. And my secondary reason is I'm starting to feel bad for Greg for losing all the time. And I realize Greg is the judge on the next case. So I kind of want to butter him up a little bit and make sure he's not too cranky. So, for the second time as judge, I'm bringing the gavel down and saying bad contract.
You heard it here first, folks. Matt Duchene, a solid number two.
A number three center, Matt Duchene. Yeah.
A real good.
Scores 60 points a year forever.
Oh, sounds like somebody's trying to win on appeal.
60 Shea points Weber, forever being 3 60-point seasons in, like, 11, just for the record.
Shea Weber is currently in year 1, 2, Christ. 3, 4, what 5, 6, 7,
800? Is that right?
He's year 8 of a 14-year deal. Of course, please remember, all you kids out there, that this 14-year deal was the product of an offer sheet given to him by the Philadelphia Flyers. The Nashville Predators matched in 2012. 13.1% of the cap at the time of his signing. A annual AAV of $7,857,143, a nice round number. Currently makes $6 million in salary. Oh, it does drop a bit towards the end of his deal. In 2026, he'll only make $1 million against the cap because obviously he'll be playing that.
Well,
he'll
won't be only making $1
million dollars in salary. Right, I correct myself. Shut the fuck up. I'm the judge.
Probably get these things right.
Ryan is the prosecutor. Sean is the defense of the Shea Weber contract. Your opening statement, Ryan Lambert.
When Shea Weber's healthy, there's little doubt as to the value.
Wait, hold on. As the judge, I'm allowed to interject. Did you write these out like an essay?
Of course I did.
Yeah, I feel like you did.
I definitely did. Why wouldn't I?
It's not an oral exam. All in all, Your Honor, in summary.
I can't believe it took you two fucking things where I'm pulling out like exact numbers.
But my question is, did you actually write out the paragraph?
Yes, of course.
Are
I
you
did.
Reading from a script?
Yeah.
Okay. I wrote shit down too. I did not write it at a paragraph.
Yeah, well, that's why I've won more cases than you. And I'm gonna win this one.
Please
too. Get ready.
Please continue, Constable.
All right. When Shea Weber's healthy, there's little doubt as to the value he shockingly continues to provide to the Montreal Canadiens. The problem is he's missed about 25 games a season on average over that time, and much like peak Brent Burns, a lot of his value comes from the fact that he scores goals at an incredible rate. The marginal values of those goals over, say, what a good forward might score is questionable. To put it in basketball terms, Weber is an elite shooter on long twos. But his points have a less effective value than guys who shoot well closer to the basket. Unlike Burns, Weber scores because of his elite shooting talent and not because of shot volume. His average career shooting percentage is 8.2, and that's in line with Brent Burns' two-year peak. And so we can say, yeah, that could hold up over time, at least to some extent. The real problem with this contract is that Weber still plays heavy minutes, but seems to be losing a step, especially defensively, as time goes on, and is probably still only getting those minutes because of who he is and the reputation him scoring creates a lot of chances, and that Montreal really doesn't have anybody else to take over from him. Problematically, his having lost a step negates a lot of the offensive value that he legitimately creates. All of which is to say, Weber seems to be getting old in a hurry between the injuries and the fact that he's basically Alex Ovechkin, contributing almost nothing but goal creation. It's a valuable skill, but Weber is the same age as Ovechkin and signed for not one, not two, not three, not four, not five, but six seasons after this one. The odds are that he's going to miss more time, get worse, and eventually be a net negative player. The Habs didn't sign this contract, but they willingly traded for it in pursuit of a cup that's never going to come with Weber and Carey Price as the centerpieces of this team.
First of all, the defense concedes that Montreal will never win a cup, and we would like that entered into the record as evidence. But all of that said, look, Shea Weber, we got put aside the trade, put aside PK Subban, put aside how we got here. Like we said, this is, we're looking for this moment forward. This is obviously one of those contracts that in the context of how it was signed, you look back, it overall maybe will like how this deal worked, but we're only looking for right now. And the reality is right now, yeah, Shea Weber is 34, I think. He's at that point where productivity is going to drop, durability is going to drop. And yet, when he is on the ice, he's still a real good player. Talk to fans and media in Montreal. This guy is still a presence. This guy is still easily their most important defenseman and probably their most important skater on the team when he plays. Now, durability is an issue. I'll concede that. If he misses chunks of time, then obviously that hurts his value. But also, purely from a cap hit perspective, if he misses chunks of time, you then have access to the long-term injured reserve, which means it doesn't hurt you as much cap-wise as it could. Montreal is a team, even though they've got this contract and the Carey Price contract, which I ruled in my last column was an outright bad deal, they're still in pretty good cap shape. This is also a contract that, from a Montreal Canadiens perspective, should be relatively painless as we go in terms of being something that they can get out of. They will probably get out of it just by nature of him retiring. We can all look at the backdiving nature of the deal and figure out that he's probably not going to play for six more years. But even if he does, he can be traded. There's no trade protection. There's no movement protection. There are no more signing bonuses from here on in. It's pure, just pure salary. And the big thing that hangs over this contract is the cap recapture, which could be completely devastating to the Nashville Predators. But that's not our problem today in cap court. We're only looking at this from the perspective of the Montreal Canadiens or whichever team might acquire this contract. And those teams would not be paying cap recapture penalties. I believe Montreal is now, as of this season, clear of any penalties they would have to pay. It's the Predators' problem. It's unfair. It's a stupid rule. But it's an argument for another time. I think right now, the Montreal Canadiens have a guy. I was looking at the Corsica player rankings. They had Shea Weber as the 15th best right shooting defenseman in the league this year when he's healthy. That puts him right there on the first pair for an average team. I think 7 and change for a first pair defenseman, maybe a little high, not terrible, no trade protection to worry about, no crazy signing bonuses, something that should be and a contract that 6 years is way too much to be left on a guy this age. But he ain't playing 6 years, and even if he is, he'll be playing them in Arizona or somewhere like that if Montreal decides they need to do that. So I don't love the contract, but I don't think it's a bad contract. I think it's manageable for a team in Montreal's position.
Good arguments on both sides. I think the first thing you have to do in considering this contract is think about the origins of the contract. Is it a bad contract because it was an offer sheet deal? You obviously have to study precedent on this one. The case of Burke versus Lowe, 2007. Dustin Penner offer sheet, 8.45% of the cap. Could be seen as a bad contract, but is it a bad contract because it was matched, or is it a bad contract because it didn't achieve its aim, which was acquiring the player and scaring off the team from matching it? It's an interesting debate to be had, but perhaps a little immaterial to this decision. I agree that Shea Weber is a better player today than I ever thought he would be, because I thought he'd be broken down by this point. Ultimately, I think the contract is judged on the implications of the contract when the team has to get out of it. And as the defense pointed out, the Montreal Canadiens have no blood on their hands when Shea Weber does in fact retire before his salary drops to $1 million. Because of that very fact, and because the overall cap hit is quite manageable for a player that could still be considered an elite level defenseman when healthy, I'm going to say good contract and rule for the defense.
Wow. Good contract. Not just not guilty on charges of being a bad contract, but you're giving him actually a little extra boost.
If you've got a guy signed in perpetuity and he retires and you don't get hit by any cap recapture penalties, but someone else does.
Okay, it's such a stupid rule. I renew my prediction that the Predators will never pay a cap recapture on that contract, because there's no way the NHL is going to let them be like $20 million underwater because of a contract they didn't even come up with.
Yeah, it may not have been a good contract when they matched it, but cap recapture and those rules, insofar as what it means to Montreal, may have flipped the script on it a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I rule for the defense. Oh, boy. Here we go.
Oh, Lord.
Oh, and Ryan gets to be the judge on this one. By God. Mitch Marner.
Oof.
Mitch Marner. Mitch Marner has a six-year deal worth $65,358,000. Great. Six-year deal. No move in the last 2 years. For the prosecution, down goes Brown.
I'm the prosecution on this one. Awesome.
Yeah.
Look, I'm a Leafs fan. I'm a Mitch Marner fan. I love this kid. He's all sorts of fun to watch. He's one of the best young players that this team has had in the 30-plus years I've been watching them. This isn't about, is Mitch Marner a good player or not? This is Mitch Marner's contract good or not? The problem with Mitch Marner's contract, and we all know the whole soap opera that went last summer, the Leafs paid not just top dollar, but really above and beyond anything that had ever been done for this sort of player before. And when I say this sort of player, I'm talking about a guy who is a winger. I'm talking about a guy who is still has several years of RFA status to go. So this isn't Artemi Panarin. This wasn't an unrestricted free agent. And this isn't an elite two-way center. This is a guy where there is an established market for what wingers get in this league. And Mitch Marner surpassed that by a pretty significant margin. And when something like that happens, I think you're looking at a bad contract unless one of two things follows. The first is that the player emerges as a legitimately elite, top of the position sort of superstar. This is the Leon Draisaitl effect. When that contract got signed, we all went, ooh, that's too much for a guy like that. And then Leon Draisaitl emerged as a legitimate Hart Trophy candidate. Now, Mitch Marner, we've only got 1 year to work with, but he had a pretty good year. He missed some time with injury. He was good. Mitch Marner had a good season. Mitch Marner's not getting any Hart Trophy votes this year. Mitch Marner is arguably only the second or third best forward on his own team, let alone being the second or third best winger in the whole league, which is where he would need to be to justify this contract. That's one thing that has to happen. The other thing that can happen is you get a contract like this, and this happened a little bit with Draisaitl as well, it has to reset the marketplace. So Mitch Marner signs for $10.8 million, and everyone goes, wow, that's a lot for an RFA. But then the guys who follow sign for similar amounts, and we start moving up, and then you look back and you say, okay, that reset the marketplace, but it makes sense now that we look at what other guys are got. And I would argue the marketplace needs to be reset. Young players like Mitch Marner should be making more than they typically have made. Older players who are signing deals when they're 28 or 30 should be making less. We all agree that's how it should be, but how did it actually turn out? And of course, we know that, right? Like the RFAs after Mitch Marner, Braden Point, Mikko Rantanen, comparable guys, did not end up resetting the marketplace. They ended up taking deals that were right back in that $8 million range that guys like that have typically had. And so when you look at Mitch Marner's comparables, you're looking at guys like Mikko Rantanen, similar player. He took a $9.25 million cap hit on a contract of the same length. Look at Nikita Kucherov. This guy wins an MVP, $9.5 million. Playing wing, playing the same position as Mitch Marner. It was an overpay. It was an overreaction to the William Nylander situation. It's a situation that is creating significant cap problems for the Maple Leafs. They went much higher than they probably needed to because they didn't want to play hardball with a local kid who was playing hardball right back at them. They've ended up with a deal that sits as a very obvious outlier as far as what younger players who play wing are getting. And through all of that, by the way, they only ended up buying 2 years of UFA status. So it's not even like you can look and say they saved a ton of money down the line, because he's going to hit UFA when he's still pretty close to the prime of his career. I get why they were doing it. I love watching the player. I'm happy he's under contract. I'm happy he's not sitting at home. But if this is cap court, we're looking at just purely on the cap hit. Unfortunately, at least so far, this has been a bad deal, if only because the market did not follow along after it was signed.
Your Honor, market schmarket. The money is nuts, let's be real. But the Leafs got the term that they were looking for, extending Marner one season beyond Austin Matthews to avoid a calamity of contractual stress and strain in 2024. It's a contract that gobbles up 2 seasons of unrestricted free agency. Now, it certainly wasn't signed with the idea that the salary cap would be flattened by a global pandemic. We can all agree on that. So this is a win for the Leafs because they were doing the thing that hockey fans have begged their teams to do and that the prosecution itself said is an admirable aspect of the contract, which is to sign dynamic young players to big money deals rather than throw that money at aging assets like the Leafs used to do for decades. They have a Stanley Cup window. Mitch Marner helped prop it open. The 12th best points per game average in the last 2 years in the National Hockey League. Sir, the defense proclaims this Mitch Marner contract to be not guilty.
This is a tough one because I agree with pretty much everything that was said on both sides. The young players are improperly valued. They are undervalued in this league. It's a situation where, is Mitch Marner worth more than, say, a Matt Duchene? Yes, of course he is. Of course he is.
Absolutely. Yes.
And that's even, taking into account the different positions and the different circumstances and all that kind of stuff. But, if you're judging a player just on what he brings on the ice, Mitch Marner is a more valuable player than the vast majority of forwards in the league. With that having been said, Sean's point about it not resetting the market and now looking like a huge outlier does make it a problem, especially because the Maple Leafs have these other cap crunches, because they did what most smart teams should do, and they went out and acquired a shitload of high-end talent. The problem is that they paid top dollar for every single one of those guys. And you can do that as long as you have a pretty solid foundation of lower-end players, and I'm not sure the Maple Leafs do. That's not really Mitch Marner's fault, though. But what I think ultimately is the deciding factor in this contract is the fact that, they only got him for 6 years, If this was an eight-year deal, I'd feel a lot better about it. But I don't, and so for that reason, I cannot say this is a good contract.
Well, shit. All right, last one. Drew Doughty of the Los Angeles Kings. Man, I can't. This is where I've been anticipating what the defense is going to be on this one, because it's going to be good. It's got to be epic. Drew Doughty.
So can we just do the peek behind the scenes here? Which is originally we had this as 5 guys. And then I think it was Greg threw Doughty's name out there. And because we'd already done 5, we were like, okay, well, everyone should do each job twice. So it fell into place who had to do what. And the reaction when Ryan found out that he was the defense. I want to hear this paragraph. I am giddy with excitement.
It is pretty epic. All right. So to set the scene, Drew Doughty signed an 8-year, $88 million contract. On July 1st, 2018, full no-move clause the first 4 years of the deal, modified no-trade for the last 4 years of the deal. Doughty makes a base salary of he's got signing bonuses for the first 4 years. His base salary doesn't go below $11 million for the last 4 years. This is a very lucrative contract. Drew Doughty, 8 years, $88 million, Los Angeles Kings defenseman. Oh, by the way, he's 30.
Yeah.
Please, Mr. Ghost Brown, the prosecution.
Please, Mr. Ghost Brown is my father. You can you can call me Dad. All right. Look, when Drew Doughty signed this contract in 2018, he was coming off a season where he was the runner-up for the Norris Trophy. Now, we can argue whether he should have been, but he was clearly still very much in the conversation of the very best of the best defensemen out there, and there was the Erik Karlsson situation looming. So you can maybe understand why the Kings felt they had to borrow a phrase from the last case, reset the marketplace. And this deal kind of did, in that Karlsson went and gotten the same number, but the first year after he signs this, the contract hasn't even kicked in yet because it's an extension. So he plays his first year, 2018-19. We see a drop in his play. He suddenly is not playing like a Norris candidate anymore. Now year two, which is year one of the actual contract, even worse on a team that's even worse. And yeah, you know, maybe there's some crossover in that. Are the Kings bad because Drew Doughty's bad, or is Drew Doughty bad because the Kings team around him is no longer a cup contender? It's probably a bit of both. But this guy has turned 30. He's got seven more years left on a contract that has full no movement protection for the first half, and then turns into a modified no trade. This is a contract that right now requires Drew Doughty to be a Norris conversation type of player. Doesn't have to win every year, doesn't have to be a finalist every year, but he's got to be in that conversation as among the best defensemen in the league. The last 2 years, he has not been. And those are the 2 years since he signed the deal. He's got seven more years to go. Now, have there been defensemen who have played well into their 30s, well into their late 30s, and still been elite guys? Yeah, there have been a few. Most defensemen do not do that. And we're betting against aging curves if we think Drew Doughty is going to suddenly resurrect himself as being an elite Norris candidate. The reality is this is a classic case of a guy who was great for a long time for one team, helped them win Stanley Cups, and then when it was time for his big UFA contract, he got paid based on the past, not based on the future. This was a reward for what he had done, not for what he was going to do in the future. I get to some extent why the Kings felt they had no choice. You can't just is one of the most popular players in franchise history. He has a lot of leverage, but he used that leverage to get a contract that is at the very top of the food chain as far as defensemen in the NHL, and will be for a very long time. And he's not there anymore. He may not even be all that close anymore. This is bad today, and it is going to get much, much worse as it goes for the LA Kings.
All right.
Well, look.
Mr. Lambert for the defense.
The first thing you got to say is when you're rebuilding, you have to have some expensive contracts on the books to make sure you hit the cap floor. So let's just get that out of the way. The Kings saw that they needed to rebuild, and they were like, well, we got to throw some money around. In those cases, you might as well make it a guy who's beloved by your franchise, won you two Stanley Cups, and was briefly, if perhaps wrongly, considered one of the best players in the world. Hockey's a sport that still values veteran leadership and things like, quote-unquote, knowing how to win. If you're bringing in a ton of young players, guys like Doughty, who have won at every single level of the competition in, you know, he won World Junior Gold, he won Olympic Gold, he won World Cup Gold, he has two Stanley Cups, he won a World Championship Silver, and he'd probably have a World Championship Gold if he wasn't so busy getting the Kings into the playoffs every couple of years. So, look, with this contract, he gets to retire as a King. He gets his number up in the rafters. He probably is a Hockey Hall of Famer, all that shit. Mm-hmm. People like that. And so all I'm saying is I'm trying to plead this down from not the worst contract in the league. That's it.
Plead it down to what? What charge are you trying to plead it down to?
I'll take one of the five worst in the league. This fucking thing stinks. I can't. What do you want me to say?
Does the prosecution agree to this plea deal?
No. No, we – well, I mean, look, I'm here to get a guilty. So if one of the five worst contracts in the league gets me a guilty plea, then yes, I will – I'll take that plea and we'll throw this contract – we'll give it life in prison instead of giving it to chair if that's what's being offered. But it's a bad contract.
All right. There you go. The ruling is life in prison, no chance of parole, but he is spared from – Old Sparky. There you go. Salary cap court. I think we did some good today. We really, really exposed some truths on this podcast today about these contracts. In the limited time we have left, there were two other topics. I felt like we should just combine them and do overrated, underrated, favorite, least favorite on wrestling theme songs. What say you?
Great. Ooh.
Sure.
Okay. Because there was an awesome thing that BT Sport put out, which was the World Cup of Wrestling theme songs, where they did four different groups, like World Cup groups, which, by the way, I am so fucking bracketed out that this format was so refreshing.
Yes,
to see.
Agreed.
To see kind of like the European pool version of a bracket. Fucking brilliant. But okay, so overrated, underrated, favorite, least favorite wrestling theme songs. I'll go overrated first, and I'll just say it. The NWO theme song is overrated, and I'll tell you why. Although it did help set the vibe of arguably the most successful stable in the history of wrestling, I would argue that I got more chills and had a more visceral reaction to Hollywood Hulk Hogan using Jimi Hendrix's Voodoo Child than I did the NWO theme. The Voodoo Child theme to me was like the Pokemon evolution of the NWO theme. And I always like that theme better. So I will say overrated NWO theme.
Yeah, I mean, that's wrong. I think a lot. Let me put it this way. When I sent this to another friend of mine who's a big wrestling fan, he's like, I think Robert Roode's entrance music.
Glorious.
Yes, glorious. Is yeah. One of the five best in the history of wrestling, to which I say,
agreed.
No, it isn't. It's good.
Oh, fuck
it's
off.
Good.
It's fantastic.
It's good. Is it one of the five best theme songs? It's not even the best theme song in WWE today.
It crossed over to Arena Anthem, though. I mean, like, it's that's how epic it is.
Yeah. Well, again, like, it's not even as good as Shinsuke Nakamura's. So I don't know what we're really talking about when people say it's like one of the five best of all time. It's great. It's again, good theme song. Very good. It's not that good.
Big fan of the fiddle, are you? All right.
It is. It's so tough with wrestling theme songs to separate them from the performer. And like, yeah, you're like Bobby Roode in NXT, as I understand it, was like a big star. And then he comes over to WWE and everybody sings along to the theme song, and I'm going to say overrated as a wrestling theme song, because I hear this one mentioned a lot as like one of the very best ever, and I think there's a difference between being a good song that plays when a wrestler walks to the ring versus being a good wrestling theme song. And so I'm going to say my overrated is whatever the Randy Orton song is called. Because yes. I get that's why people might like that as a song, but it's slow. It's kind of this plodding. It's a little too dramatic. It doesn't have like the big punch of, you know, this is a, you know, that some of the other songs have. If I had to listen to a song on my iPod, I'd probably put that above a whole bunch of theme songs that work better in pro wrestling. But I don't know. I think people are liking the song more than liking it for what it's supposed to do, which is get people out of their seats in a pro wrestling environment. So that's my pick.
Underrated. I'm going to go with Kane's theme song.
It's so good. It's so good.
It's so good. And like before he kind of his character became more of a fucking kind of comedic thing, or he became mayor of a town, whatever the fuck, like
that song combined with the red lighting, combined with the fire, combined with the mystery of the who's this disfigured monster behind the mask, all of that shit fit together so well. And that theme song is so fucking good as far as, like, you need a song that's going to really, like, strike some terror in you, but at the same time be good enough to distract you while a giant plotting man walks to the ring very deliberately.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. And so I always love the Kane theme song as underrated.
Yeah, it's great. For me, I think it wasn't even on the bracket, and I was a little surprised by it. But a perfect again, like tying the wrestler to the song and that kind of thing, a perfect encapsulation of that is the post like being the freak in the basement kind of a guy, like the rock and roll Mankind theme song.
With the
car crash and the hand claps and the big guitar riff.
That Ugly Kid Joe kind of sounding song?
Yeah, exactly. That song's great. And again, yeah, it's a perfect encapsulation of what that era of Mick Foley's career was all about, where it's like, oh yeah, I'm just going to like almost die every single night. It doesn't matter if it's Hell in a Cell. It doesn't matter if it's Sunday Night Heat. I'm taking an insane bump. And you're gonna fucking love it, and that's what it was. It was awesome.
You know what I'm amazed didn't catch on is it was a Mick Foley thing when he was when he first came in, having a different song as your exit song.
Yes,
yeah.
After you've won the match, and in fact, the fact that he came out to like this psycho crazy music, and then when he won, it was like this very soft, like almost like what have I
soft
done?
Music.
Like,
yeah. Yeah, that was a really cool gimmick.
I'm
I
just
agree.
Amazed
that's,
they don't, you know, it'd be
pull.
An excuse to have two songs for everybody. And anyways, my pick for underrated is, and this is going to be a little dicey because I'm actually going underrated as opposed to a song that I think is a great wrestling theme song. I don't think this one's great, but I think it's better than people give it credit for. And I see it show up a lot on like worst theme song lists. And I'm going to push back on that partly because I'm Canadian and I'm a mark for this guy, but the WWE Bret Hart song, which was just pure, like, first of all, it had the great opening moment, which is like, that's 80% of a wrestling theme song is you have to hit with something that's
yes,
instantly
absolutely. 100%.
The guitar. And then it was just, you know, a lot of people at the time, this was back in the era where you had like Shawn Michaels had this crazy kitschy song with lyrics and a lot of other guys had that. And this was just this methodical guitar riff that was just, you know, no lyrics, no fancy gimmicks, but it really fit the character well of like, all right, it's when Bret Hart came out, it's time to get serious. It's, you know, mm-hmm. we're not doing gimmicks. We're not doing a bunch of fireworks and stuff. Like it stuff's about to get real. And it worked with that. And it also has like, when you hear it, like when he's coming out, it had this kind of thing where there's like this wailing guitar that worked pretty well, but they then took that concept and perfected it with the Rock's theme song a few years later, where, you know, he'd be up on the turnbuckle like right at that moment that it hit, and you're sort of like, okay, that's the DNA of how they got to something that worked a lot better. But I still feel like it gets like disrespected as a you know, crappy, like, oh, it's just some guy playing the guitar. I think it actually worked really well for the character and gave him a building block that they did better things with afterwards.
Favorite is tough because I have a lot of favorites, but I would say like a few off the top of my head. The Brood theme is one of my favorite songs. Yeah. I think it's awesome. And it fit well, perfectly with what's going on.
I don't know
playing.
That there's ever been a higher ratio of like theme song quality to
stable
what they
quality.
Actually used it on.
To stable quality. Yeah. I think Vince McMahon's No Chance in Hell is perfect for the character.
Absolutely.
And I also always really loved the fact that Kurt Angle's song worked both as a celebration of an Olympic champion and then a signal that here comes an asshole that you're going to want to boo.
Yep.
Is a really amazing, malleable theme. But to go back to Sean's point, if you're looking for a theme song that basically is the reason why there is affection for a talent, I think you have to go old school and you have to say that the best theme song in WWE history was the Demolition theme song, because that song hits and those guys come out in their S&M gear, and it's the fucking coolest thing you've ever seen. Then you realize they're just a couple old guys that can't really do anything except like punch. But the whole point of them coming out to that song through them taking off the masks is the fucking coolest thing you've ever seen when you were a kid. That's, Demolition theme song.
I would not have been high on my list, but that's not a bad. The all-time highlight for that song is the year they came out as 1 and 2 in the Royal Rumble, and people just lost their minds. And then you're like, oh right, these two guys are just gonna like punch each other. And then
it wasn't a very good team. They were like, they couldn't really work that well. But like,
it was the a rip-off song of
of the Road Warriors.
Yeah, that was it.
Yeah, but still fine. Like the theme song for me as a kid was like. That was what probably like kids in the 90s felt about the NWO. Like when you heard that theme song, you're just like, oh, fuck, it's on.
My favorite is one, speaking of arena crossovers, it's The Game. Triple H.
Oh, yeah. Like, there you go.
And let's put it this way. It's so good that people think it's a Motorhead song. It was written by the WWE composer for Motorhead, but it is not written by them at all. And so like everything about it is perfect for Triple H. It's perfect for Motorhead. And again, like if you were just at an arena and you didn't know anything about wrestling and that song came on, you'd be like, damn, this song kicks ass. Motorhead's cool. But you know, it's a wrestling theme song. It was always supposed to be a wrestling theme song. And that to me, like that's the mark of a song being so like a song so good that you're like, this couldn't be a wrestling theme song, but it was one.
Mm-hmm. I literally thought that was a Motorhead song until just now.
Actually.
Wow. Yeah, okay.
Again, proof of why it's so good in the first place.
So I actually had a different one in my back pocket because I assumed we would have already touched on this one, but we haven't. So I'm gonna use what I think is inarguably the greatest wrestling theme song of all time, just in terms of, and again, this is not it's not a great song, but it's a great wrestling theme song, has the perfect opening, fits the character perfectly, everything. The Stone Cold Steve Austin.
Absolutely.
You know, the glass break right there is, you know, iconic, and everything that went along with it. You know, just fit him perfectly. You hear that song, you can see him like marching down to the ring while the crowd goes crazy, and it's perfect. It, even though it's not a great, you know, no lyrics, or at least in most of the versions, is it just Razor Ramon's theme song sped up a little bit? Yeah, it actually is, but it worked perfectly. Sometimes you make a small change to something and it becomes pretty much perfect. So I'm gonna say that one, and because to me, it's everything else is fighting for second place as far as this particular genre of music.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's a good choice. Least favorite for me is an easy one. I hated this song, and I hated it specifically because, like, again, like you go back to the original NWO theme. Like, I find that to be overrated, but it's effective. It's an effective song for what it does. When Eric Bischoff came to the WWE, he had a song called "I'm Back" as his theme.
Yeah.
It's terrible.
Yeah, it's
like supposed to kind of be his No Chance in Hell. And instead it's just like, there's no real theme to it. And it's just like this guy kind of like noise when he's singing. It's fucking terrible. And to go from him strutting out in his leather jacket and an NWO t-shirt, you know, to the NWO theme, to this fucking hacky shit song, was a real downer for a guy who I think is a real effective character. So least favorite of all time, the Eric Bischoff "I'm Back" song.
Mine is it's the X-Pac
the X-Pac DX remix one.
Yeah, the theme from X-Pac.
Oh, yeah, it's terrible.
By Connecticut Yankee. Yeah, that shit sucked, dude. And like,
because they had to like do it like the DX theme, so it begins with the fucking Connecticut Yankee guy going X-Pac, like he's doing a fucking Surge commercial.
Yeah, it's
or
not
something.
It's not very good.
It's terrible. Yeah. That's a great choice.
Thank you.
By mine, I think is from pretty much the same era. is the Big Show theme song. Where
oh, come on.
This crappy, like, you've got this 7-foot-tall, 400-pound whatever guy that you steal away from the other rival federation. He's supposed to come in as this, like, unstoppable monster. And because whoever the dude who does the theme songs for the WWE, I guess, was in, like, a little blues rock phase, you've got this just awful, it starts with, like, it doesn't have a good beginning. It's just somebody saying the name of the character. It sucks, and it's a big part of the reason why he never got over to the degree that he probably should have, and was always kind of this like perpetual mid-card presence because his songs sucked.
I my theory on that was that they were trying to make that theme song sound like the Roseanne theme song.
Right, which is really what you want when you've just paid millions of dollars to bring a guy over.
It does seem like a kind of a sitcom theme song, right? Like, you know, you do your little vignette at the beginning of the show, and then all of a sudden, well.
Yeah, it's exactly. And now he is in a sitcom.
That's exactly.
So maybe it was a long play. It was the long play.
All right, that's awesome. Great job out of everybody on that. Great job out of us on the salary cap court. Big long fucking show for your ears this week. Hopefully you've got your Raycon earbuds in and you're feeling the comfort as you listen to this epic fucking 2-hour podcast. That's the show. Read me at ESPN. Listen to ESPN on Ice. Go ahead, Ryan.
Sign up for Puck Soup Patreon. I got a newsletter on there. We do multiple bonus episodes. We're doing a bonus episode this week, so check it out.
Find me on The Athletic. This week was went through which birthday produces the best starting six in NHL history. I took a look at all these contracts that are expiring on July 1st, and obviously that's not going to happen if we're in the middle of the playoffs. But what if it did, and all of these guys just became free agents in the middle of a playoff series? And today I have a post where I ranked the top 10 prospects on your favorite team. I don't know who your favorite team is, but I'm pretty sure my list is accurate. So that should give you a sense how much I've got going on in the old list of topics. And go check those out.
Let it never be said we didn't give you another 2-hour podcast. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Take care.
See you.
Bye.
Sticks and hits and goals and saves and slap shots and goons. We've got sportly commentary to an NFL commute. But we also cover movies, TV shows, hits and tunes. It's your weekly bowl of hockey and nonsense. Puck Soup.